This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Dark Sacred Night. Written by Michael Connelly. Read by Christine Lakin and Titus Welliver. Dedication. For Detective Mitzi Roberts, Renee's inspiration. Ballard. Chapter 1. The patrol officers had left the front door open. They thought they were doing her a favor, airing the place out. But that was a violation of crime scene protocol regarding evidence containment. Bugs could go in and out. Touch DNA could be disturbed by a breeze through the house. Odors were particulate. Airing out a crime scene meant losing part of that crime scene. But the patrol officers didn't know all of that. The report that Ballard had gotten from the watch lieutenant was that the body was 2 to 3 days old in a closed house with the air conditioning off. In his words, the place was as ripe as a bag of skunks. There were 2 black and whites parked along the curb in front of Ballard. 3 blue suits were standing between them, waiting for her. Ballard didn't really expect them to have stayed inside with the body. Up above, an airship circled at 300 feet. Holding its beam on the street. It looked like a leash of light tethering the circling craft, keeping it from flying away. Ballard killed the engine but sat in her city ride for a moment. She had parked in front of the gap between 2 houses and could look out at the lights of the city spreading in a vast carpet below. Not many people realized that Hollywood Boulevard wound up into the mountains, narrow and tight, to where it was strictly residential and far, in all ways, from the glitz and grime of the Hollywood Boulevard tourist mecca, where visitors posed with costumed superheroes and sidewalk stars. Up here, it was money and power, and Ballard knew that a murder in the hills always brought out the department's big guns. She was just babysitting. She would not have this case for long. It would go to West Bureau Homicide, or possibly even robbery-homicide division downtown, depending on who was dead and what their social status was. She looked away from the view and tapped the overhead light so she could see her notebook. She had just come from her day's first call-out, a routine break-in off Melrose, and had her notes for the report she would write once she got back to Hollywood division. She flipped to a fresh page and wrote the time, 1:47 a.m., and the address. She added a note about the clear and mild weather conditions. She then turned the light off and got out, leaving the blue flashers on. Moving to the back of the car, she popped the trunk to get to her crime scene kit. It was Monday morning, her first shift of a week running solo, and Ballard knew she would need to get at least 1 more wear out of her suit, and possibly 2. That meant not fouling it with the stink of decomp. At the trunk, she slipped off her jacket, folded it carefully, and placed it in one of the empty cardboard evidence boxes. She removed her crime scene coveralls from a plastic bag and pulled them on over her boots, slacks, and blouse. She zipped them up to her chin and, placing 1 boot and then the other up on the bumper, tightened the Velcro cuffs around her ankles. After she did the same around her wrists, her clothes were hermetically sealed. Out of the kit, she grabbed disposable gloves and the breathing mask she'd used at autopsies when she was formerly with RHD, closed the trunk, and walked up to join the 3 uniformed officers. As she approached, she recognized Sergeant Stan Dvorak, the area boss, and 2 officers whose longevity on the graveyard shift got them the cushy and slow Hollywood Hills beat. Dvorak was balding and paunchy with the kind of hip spread that comes with too many years in a patrol car. He was leaning against the fender of one of the cars with his arms folded in front of his chest. He was known as the Relic. Anybody who actually liked being on the midnight shift and lasted significant years on it ended up with a nickname. Dvorak was the current record holder, celebrating his 10th year on the late show just a month before. The officers with him, Anthony Anzalone and Dwight Doucette, were Casper and Deuce. Ballard, with just 3 years on Graveyard, had no nickname bestowed upon her yet. At least, none that she knew about. "Fellas," Ballard said.
"Whoa, Sally Ride," Dvorak said. "When's the shuttle taking off?"
Ballard spread her arms to display herself. She knew the coveralls were baggy and looked like a spacesuit. She thought maybe she had just been christened with a nickname.
"That would be never," she said.
"So what do we got that chased you out of the house?"
"It's bad in there," said Anzalone.
"It's been cooking," Doucette added.
The relic pushed off the trunk of his car and got serious.
"Female, white, 50s. Looks like blunt force trauma and facial lacerations," he said. "Somebody worked her over pretty good. Domicile in disarray. Could have been a break-in."
"Sexual assault?" Ballard asked.
"Her nightgown's pulled up. She's exposed."
"Okay, I'm going in. Which one of you brave lads wants to walk me through it?" There were no immediate volunteers.
"Deuce, you've got the high number," Dvorak said.
"Shit," said Doucette.
Doucette was the newest officer of the three, so he had the highest serial number. He pulled a blue bandana up from around his neck and over his mouth and nose.
"You look like a fucking Crip," Anzalone said.
"Why? Because I'm black?" Doucette asked.
"Because you're wearing a fucking blue bandana," Anzalone said. "If it was red, I'd say you look like a fucking Blood."
"Just show her," Dvorak said. "I really don't want to be here all night."
Doucette broke off the banter and headed toward the open door of the house. Ballard followed.
"How'd we get this thing so late anyway?" she asked.
"Next door neighbor got a call from the victim's niece back in New York," Doucette said. "Neighbor has a key and the niece asked him to check because the lady wasn't responding to social media or cell calls for a few days. The neighbor opens the door, gets hit with the funk, and calls us."
"At 1 o'clock in the morning?"
"No, much earlier. But all of PM Watch was tied up last night on a caper with a 459 suspect and on a perimeter around Park La Brea till end of watch. Nobody got up here, and then it got passed on to us at roll call. We came by as soon as we could."
Ballard nodded. The perimeter around a robbery suspect sounded suspect to her. More likely, she thought, the buck had been passed shift to shift because nobody wants to work a possible body case that has been cooking in a closed house.
"Where's the neighbor now?" Ballard asked.
"Back home," Doucette said. "Probably taking a shower and sticking VapoRub up his nose. He's never going to be the same again."
"We gotta get his prints to exclude him, even if he says he didn't go in."
"Roger that. I'll get the print car up here."
Snapping on her latex gloves, Ballard followed Doucette over the threshold and into the house. The breathing mask was almost useless. The putrid odor of death hit her strongly, even though she was breathing through her mouth. Doucette was tall and broad-shouldered. Ballard could see nothing until she was well into the house and had stepped around him. The house was cantilevered out over the hillside, making the view through the floor-to-ceiling glass wall a stunning sheath of twinkling light. Even at this hour, the city seemed alive and pulsing with grand possibilities.
"Was it dark in here when you came in?" Ballard asked.
"Nothing was on when we got here," said Doucette.
Ballard noted the answer. No lights on could mean that the intrusion occurred during the daytime or late at night, after the homeowner had gone to bed. She knew that most home invasions were daytime capers. Doucette, who was also wearing gloves, hit a wall switch by the door and turned on a line of ceiling lamps. The interior was an open loft design, taking advantage of the panorama from any spot in the living room, dining room, or kitchen. The staggering view was counterbalanced on the rear wall by three large paintings that were part of a series depicting a woman's red lips. Ballard noticed broken glass on the floor near the kitchen island, but saw no shattered windows.
"Any sign of a break-in?" she asked.
"Not that we saw," Doucette said. "There's broken shit all over the place, but
no broken windows, no obvious point of entry that we found.
Okay.
The body's down here.
He moved into a hallway off the living room and held his hand over the bandana and his mouth as a second line of protection against the intensifying odor. Ballard followed. The house was a single-level contemporary. She guessed it was built in the 50s, when one level was enough. Nowadays, anything going up in the hills was multi-level and built to the maximum extent of code. They passed open doorways to a bedroom and a bathroom, then entered a master bedroom that was in disarray, with a lamp lying on the floor, its shade dented and bulb shattered. Clothes were strewn haphazardly over the bed, and a long-stemmed glass that had contained what looked like red wine was snapped in two on the white rug, its contents spread in a splash stain.
"Here you go," Doucette said.
He pointed through the open door of the bathroom and then stepped back to allow Ballard in first. Ballard stood in the doorway but did not enter the bathroom. The victim was face up on the floor. She was a large woman, with her arms and legs spread wide. Her eyes were open, her lower lip torn, and her upper right cheek gashed, exposing grayish-pink tissue. A halo of dried blood from an unseen scalp wound surrounded her head on the white tile squares. A flannel nightgown with hummingbirds on it was pulled up over the hips and bunched above the abdomen and around the breasts. Her feet were bare and 3 feet apart. There was no visible bruising or injury to the external genitalia. Ballard could see herself in a floor-to-ceiling mirror on the opposite wall of the room. She squatted down in the doorway and kept her hands on her thighs. She studied the tiled floor for footprints, blood, and other evidence. Besides the halo that had pooled and dried around the dead woman's head, an intermittent ribbon of small blood smears was noticeable on the floor between the body and the bedroom.
"Deuce, go close the front door," she said.
Okay, Doucette said.
"Any reason?"
"Just do it. Then check the kitchen."
"For what?"
"A water bowl on the floor. Go."
Doucette left, and Ballard heard his heavy footsteps move back up the hallway. She stood and entered the bathroom, stepping gingerly alongside the wall until she came up close on the body and squatted again. She leaned down, putting a gloved hand on the tiles for balance, in an attempt to see the scalp wound. The dead woman's dark brown hair was too thick and curly for her to locate it. Ballard looked around the room. The bathtub was surrounded by a marble sill holding multiple jars of bath salts and candles burned down to nothing. There was a folded towel on the sill as well. Ballard shifted so she could see into the tub. It was empty, but the drain stopper was down. It was the kind with a rubber lip that creates a seal. Ballard reached over, turned on the cold water for a few seconds, and then turned it off. She stood up and stepped over to the edge of the tub. She had put in enough water to surround the drain. She waited and watched. "There's a water bowl."
Ballard turned. Doucette was back.
"Did you close the front door?" she asked.
"It's closed," Doucette said.
"Okay.
Look around. I think it's a cat. Something small. You'll have to call animal control."
"What?"
Ballard pointed down at the dead woman. "An animal did that. A hungry one. They start with the soft tissue."
"Are you fucking kidding me?"
Ballard looked back into the tub. Half of the water she had put in was gone. The drain's rubber seal had a slow leak. "There's no bleeding with the facial injuries," she said. "That happened post-mortem. The wound on the back of the head is what killed her." Doucette nodded.
"Someone came up and cracked her skull from behind," he said.
"No," Ballard said. "It's an accidental death."
"How?"
Doucette asked. Ballard pointed to the array of items on the bathtub sill.
"Based on decomp, I'd say it happened 3 nights ago," she said. She turns out the lights in the house to get ready for bed. Probably that lamp on the floor in the bedroom was the one she left on. She comes in here, fills the tub, lights her candles, gets her towel ready. The hot water steams the tiles and she slips. Maybe when she remembered she left her glass of wine on the bed table. Or when she started pulling up the nightgown so she could get in the tub.
What about the lamp and the spilled wine?
Doucette asked. The cat.
So, you just stood here and figured all this out?
Ballard ignored the question. She was carrying a lot of weight, she said. Maybe a sudden redirection as she was getting undressed.
Oh, I forgot my wine.
Causes her to slip, and she cracks her skull on the lip of the tub. She's dead. The candles burn out. The water slowly leaks down the drain. This explanation only brought silence from Doucette. Ballard looked down at the dead woman's ravaged face. The second day or so, the cat got hungry, Ballard concluded. It went a little nuts. Then it found her.
Jesus, Doucette said.
Get your partner in here, Deuce. Find the cat.
Well, wait a minute. If she was about to take a bath, why is she already in her nightgown? You put the nightgown on after the bath, don't you?
Who knows? Maybe she comes home from work or dinner out, gets into night clothes, gets comfortable, maybe watches TV, then decides to take a bath. Ballard gestured to the mirror. She was also obese, she said. Maybe she didn't like looking at herself naked in the mirror. So she comes home, gets into night clothes, and stays dressed until it's time to get in the tub. Ballard turned to go past Doucette and step out of the room. Find the cat, she said. Chapter 2 By 3 a.m., Ballard had cleared the scene of the death investigation and was back at Hollywood Division, working in a cubicle in the Detective Bureau. That vast room, which housed the workstations of 48 detectives by day, was deserted after midnight, and Ballard always had her pick of the place. She chose a desk in the far corner, away from spillover noise and radio chatter from the watch commander's office down the front hallway. At 5:07, she could sit down and disappear behind the computer screen and the half walls of the workstation, like a soldier in a foxhole. She could focus and get her report writing done. The report on the residential break-in that she had rolled on earlier in the night was completed first, and now she was ready to type up the death report on the bathtub case. She would classify the death as undetermined pending autopsy. She had covered her bases, called in a crime scene photographer, and documented everything, including the cat. She knew a determination of accidental death might be second-guessed by the victim's family, and maybe even her superiors. She was confident, however, that the autopsy would find no indications of foul play, and the death would eventually be ruled accidental. She was working alone. Her partner, John Jenkins, was on bereavement leave. There were no replacements for detectives who worked the late show. Ballard was halfway through the first night of at least a week going solo. It all depended on when Jenkins came back. His wife had endured a long, painful death from cancer. It had torn him up, and Ballard told him to take all the time he needed. She opened her notebook to the page containing the details she had written about the second investigation, and then called up a blank incident report on her screen. Before beginning, she dipped her chin and pulled the collar of her blouse up to her nose. She thought she picked up the slight odor of decomposition and death, but couldn't be sure if it had permeated her clothes or was simply an olfactory memory. Still, it meant that her plan to wear the suit again that week was not going to work out. It was going to the cleaners. While her head was down, she heard the metal-on-metal bang of a file drawer being closed. She looked up over the workstation divider to the far side of the bureau, where four-drawer file cabinets ran the length of the room. Every pair of detectives was assigned a four-drawer stack for storage. But the man Ballard saw now opening another drawer to check its contents was not a detective she recognized. and she knew them all from once-a-month squad meetings that drew her to the station during daylight hours. The man who was checking the cabinet, seemingly at random, had gray hair and a mustache. Ballard instinctively knew he didn't belong. She scanned the entire squad room to see if anybody else was there. The rest of the place was deserted. The man opened and closed yet another drawer. Ballard used the sound to cover getting up from her chair. She squatted down and, with the row of work cubicles as a blind, moved to the central aisle, which would allow her to come up behind the intruder without being seen. She had left her suit jacket in the cardboard box in the trunk of her car. This gave her unfettered access to the Glock holstered on her hip. She put her hand on the grip of the weapon and came to a stop 10 feet behind the man. "Hey, what's up?" she asked. The man froze. He slowly raised his hands out of the open drawer he was looking through and held them so she could see them. "That's good," Ballard said. "Now you mind telling me who you are and what you're doing?"
"Name's Bosch," he said. "I came in to see somebody."
"What, somebody hiding in the files?"
"No, I used to work here.
I know money up front. He told me I could wait in the break room while they called the guy in. I sort of started wandering. My bad." Ballard came down from high alert and took her hand off the gun. She recognized the name Bosch, and the fact that he knew the watch commander's nickname gave her some ease as well. But she was still suspicious. "You kept a key to your old cabinet?" she asked.
"No,"
Bosch said.
"It was unlocked."
Ballard could see the push-in lock at the top of the cabinet was indeed extended in unlocked position. Most detectives kept their files locked. "You got some ID?" she asked.
"Sure,"
Bosch said.
"But just so you know, I'm a police officer. I have a gun on my left hip, and you're going to see it when I reach back for my ID, okay?"
Ballard brought her hand back up to her hip. "Thanks for the heads up," she said. "Tell you what, forget the ID for now. Why don't we secure the weapon first? Then we'll—"
"There you are, Harry."
Ballard looked to her right and saw Lieutenant Monroe, the watch commander, entering the squad room. Monroe was a thin man who still walked with his hands up near his belt like a street cop, even though he rarely left the confines of the station. He had modified the belt so it carried only his gun, which was required. All of the other bulky equipment was left in a drawer of his desk. Monroe wasn't as old as Bosch, but he had the mustache that seemed to be standard with cops who came on in the 70s and 80s. He saw Ballard and read her stance.
"Ballard, what's going on?" he asked.
"He came in here and was going through the files," Ballard said. "I didn't know who he was."
"You can stand down," Monroe said. "He's good people. Used to work homicide here, back when we had a homicide table."
Monroe turned his gaze to Bosch.
"Harry, what the hell were you doing?"
he asked. Bosch shrugged.
"Just checking my old drawers," he said.
"Sort of got tired of waiting."
"Well, Dvorak's in the house and waiting in the report room," Monroe said. "And I need you to talk to him now. I don't like taking him off the street. He's one of my best guys, and I want him back out there."
"Got it," Bosch said. Bosch followed Monroe to the front hallway, which led to the watch office and the report writing room, where Dvorak was waiting. Bosch looked back at Ballard as he went and nodded. Ballard just watched him go. After they were gone, Ballard stepped over to the file drawer Bosch had last been looking in. There was a business card taped to it. That's what everybody did to mark their drawers. "Detective Cesar Rivera, Hollywood Sex Crimes Unit." She checked the contents. It was only half full, and the folders had fallen forward, probably while Bosch was leafing through them. She pushed them back up so they were standing and looked at what Rivera had written on the tabs. They were mostly victim names and case numbers. Others were marked with the main streets in Hollywood Division,
probably containing miscellaneous reports of suspicious activities or persons. She closed the drawer and checked the two above it, remembering that she had heard Bosch open at least three of them. These were like the first, containing case folders primarily listed by victim name, specific sex crime, and case number. At the front of the top drawer, she noticed a paperclip that had been bent and twisted. She studied the push-button lock on the top corner of the cabinet. It was a basic model, and she knew it could easily have been picked with a paperclip. Security of the records themselves was not a priority, because they were contained in a high-security police station. Ballard closed the drawers, pushed in the lock, and went back to the desk she had been using. She remained intrigued by Bosch's middle-of-the-night visit. She knew he had used the paperclip to unlock the file cabinet, and that indicated he had more than a casual interest in the contents of its drawers. His nostalgic story about checking out his old files had been a lie. She picked up the coffee cup on the desk and walked down the hall to the first floor break room to replenish it. The room was empty, as usual. She refilled and carried the cup over to the watch office. Lieutenant Monroe was at his desk, looking at a deployment screen that showed a map of the division and the GPS markers for the patrol units out there. He didn't hear Ballard until she came up behind him. "Quiet?" she asked.
"For the moment," Monroe said.
Ballard pointed to a cluster of three GPS locators in the same spot. "What's happening there?"
"That's the Mariscos Reyes truck. I've got three units, code 7, there."
It was a lunch break at a food truck at Sunset and Western. It made Ballard realize she had not taken a food break and was getting hungry. She wasn't sure she wanted seafood, however. "So, what did Bosch want?"
"He wanted to talk to the Relic about a body he found 9 years ago. I take it Bosch is looking into it."
"He said he's still a cop. Not for us, right?"
"Nah, he's a reserve up in the valley for San Fernando PD."
"What's San Fernando got to do with a murder down here?"
"I don't know, Ballard. You should have asked him while he was here. He's gone now."
"That was quick."
"Because the Relic couldn't remember shit."
"Is Dvorak back out there?" Monroe pointed to the three-car cluster on the screen.
"He's back out, but code 7 at the moment."
"I was thinking about going over there, getting a couple shrimp tacos. You want me to bring you back something?"
"No, I'm good. Take a rover with you."
"Roger that." On the way back to the D Bureau, she stopped in the break room and dumped the coffee in the sink and rinsed out the cup. She then pulled a rover out of the charging rack and headed out the back door of the station to her city car. The mid-watch chill had set in, and she got her suit jacket out of the trunk and put it on before driving out of the lot. The Relic was still parked at the food truck when Ballard arrived. As a sergeant, Dvorak rode in a solo car, so he had a tendency to hang with other officers on break for the company.
"Sally Ride," he said,
when he noticed Ballard studying the chalkboard menu.
"What's up, Relic?" she said.
"Halfway through another night in paradise."
"Yeah."
Ballard ordered one shrimp taco and doused it liberally with one of the hot sauces from the condiment table. She took it over to Dvorak's black and white, where he was leaning against the front fender and finishing his own meal. Two other patrol officers were eating on the hood of their car, parked in front of his. Ballard leaned against the fender next to him.
"What'd you get?"
Dvorak asked. "Shrimp," Ballard said. "I only order off the blackboard. Means it's fresh, right? They don't know what they'll have until they buy it at the docks."
"If you think so."
"I need to think so." She took her first bite. It was good, and there was no fishy taste.
"Not bad," she said.
"I had the fish special," Dvorak said. "It's probably going to take me off the street as soon as it gets down into the lower track."
"TMI, Sarge. But speaking of coming in off the street, what did that guy Bosch want with you?"
"You saw him?"
"I caught him snooping in the files in the D Bureau."
Yeah, he's kind of desperate. Looking for any angle on a case he's working.
In Hollywood?
I thought he worked for San Fernando PD these days. He does, but this is a private thing he's looking into. A girl who got killed here 9 years ago. I was the one who found the body, but damn if I could remember much that helped him.
Ballard took another bite and started nodding. She asked the next question with her mouth full of shrimp and tortilla. Who was the girl? She asked.
A runaway. Name was Daisy. She was 15 and putting it out on the street. Sad case. I used to see her on Hollywood up near Western. One night she got into the wrong car. I found her body in an alley off of Cahuenga. Came in on an anonymous call. I do remember that.
Was that her street name?
No, the real thing. Daisy Clayton.
Was Cesar Rivera working the sex table back then?
Cesar? I'm not sure. We're talking 9 years ago. He could have been.
Well, did you remember Cesar having anything to do with the case?
Bosch picked his file cabinet.
Dvorak shrugged.
I found the body and called it in, Renee. That's it, he said. I had no part in it after that. I remember they sent me down to the end of the alley to string tape and keep people out. I was just a slick sleeve.
Uniformed cops got a hash mark on their sleeves for every 5 years of service. 9 years ago, the relic was a near rookie. Ballard nodded and asked her last question. Did Bosch ask you anything I didn't just ask?
Yeah, but it wasn't about her. He asked about Daisy's boyfriend and whether I ever saw him on the street again after the murder.
Who was the boyfriend?
Just another runaway, throwaway. I knew him by his graffiti handle. Addict. Bosch said his name was Adam something. I forget. But the answer was no. I never saw him after that. Guys like that come and go.
Was that all it was? A boyfriend-girlfriend thing?
They ran together. You know, for protection. Girl like that, she needed a guy out there. Like a pimp. She worked the street. He watched out for her, and they split the profits. Except that night, he dropped the ball. Too bad for her.
Ballard nodded. She guessed that Bosch wanted to talk to Adam Addict as the person who would know the most about who Daisy Clayton knew and interacted with, and where she went on the last night of her life. He could also have been a suspect.
You know about Bosch, right? Dvorak asked.
Yeah, Ballard said. He worked in the division way back when.
You know the stars out on the front sidewalk?
Of course. There were memorial stars on the sidewalk in front of Hollywood Station, honoring officers from the division who were killed in the line of duty.
Well, there's one out there, Dvorak said. Lieutenant Harvey Pounds. The story on him was he was Bosch's LT when he worked here. And he got abducted and died of a heart attack when he was being tortured on a case Bosch was working.
Ballard had never heard the story before. Anybody ever go down for it? She asked.
Depends on who you talk to, Dvorak said. It's supposedly cleared other, but it's another mystery in the big bad city. The word was that something Bosch did got the guy killed.
Cleared other was a designation for a case that was officially closed but without an arrest or prosecution, usually because the suspect was dead or serving a life sentence for another crime, and it was not worth the time, expense, and risk of going to trial on a case that would not result in additional punishment.
Supposedly, the file on it is sealed. Hi, Jingo.
Hi, Jingo was LAPD speak for when a case involved department politics. The kind of case where a career could be diverted by a wrong move. The information on Bosch was interesting, but not on point. Before Ballard could think of a question that would steer Dvorak back toward the Daisy Clayton case, his rover squawked and he took a call from the watch office.
Ballard listened as Lieutenant Monroe dispatched him to a Beechwood Canyon address to supervise a team responding to a domestic dispute.
"Gotta go," he said, as he balled up the foil his tacos had come in. "Unless you want to ride along and back me up."
It was said in jest, Ballard knew. The relic didn't need backup from the late show detective.
"I'll see you back at the barn," she said.
"Unless that goes sideways and you need a detective." She hoped not. Domestics usually ended up being he said, she said deals, in which she acted more as a referee than a detective. Even obvious physical injuries didn't always tell the tale.
"Roger that," Dvorak said.
Chapter 3 Day watch detectives were all about traffic patterns. Most days, the majority of daysiders got to the bureau before 6 a.m., so they could split by mid-afternoon, missing the traffic swell both coming and going. Ballard counted on this when she decided she was going to ask Cesar Rivera about the Daisy Clayton case. She spent the remainder of her shift waiting on his arrival by pulling up and studying the electronic records available on the 9-year-old murder. The murder book, a blue binder full of printed reports and photos, was still the Bible of a homicide investigation in the Los Angeles Police Department, but as the world turned digital, so did the department. Using her LAPD password, Ballard was able to access most of the reports and photos from the case that had been scanned into the digital archives. The only thing missing would be the handwritten notes detectives usually shoved into the back sleeve of the murder book. Most important, she was able to view the chronological record, which was always the spine of the case, a narrative of all moves made by investigators assigned to it. Ballard determined immediately that the murder was officially classified as a cold case and assigned to the Open Unsolved Unit, which was part of the elite robbery homicide division working out of headquarters downtown. Ballard had once been assigned to the RHD and knew many of the detectives and associated players. Included in that number was her former lieutenant, who had pushed her up against a wall and tried to force himself on her in a bathroom at a squad Christmas party 3 years earlier. Her rejection of him and subsequent complaint and internal investigation was what landed her on the night shift at Hollywood Division. The complaint was determined to be unfounded because her own partner at the time did not back her up, even though he had witnessed the altercation. Department administrators decided that it would be for the good of all involved to separate Ballard and Lieutenant Robert Olivas. He stayed put in RHD, and Ballard was moved out, the message to her clear. Olivas got by unscathed, while she went from an elite unit to a posting no one ever applied or volunteered for, a slot normally reserved for the department's freaks and fuck-ups. In recent months, the irony of this was not lost on Ballard, as the country and the Hollywood entertainment industry in particular were awash in scandals involving sexual harassment and worse. The chief of police even instituted a task force to handle all the claims pouring in from the movie industry, many of them decades old. Of course, the chief's task force was composed of RHD detectives, and Olivas was one of its supervisors. The history with Olivas was not far from Ballard's mind, as her curiosity about Bosch and the case he was working sent her into the department's digital channels. Technically, she was not breaking any rules by pulling up the old reports, but the case had been moved from Hollywood when its homicide team was disbanded and placed with the Open Unsolved Unit, which was part of the Robbery Homicide Division and Olivas' domain. Ballard knew that her moves in the department database would leave a digital trail that Olivas might become aware of. If that happened, he would have the opportunity to be spiteful and initiate an internal investigation into what she was doing with an RHD case. The threat was there, but it wasn't enough to stop her. She hadn't been afraid of Olivas when he followed her into the bathroom at the Christmas party 3 years ago. She had shoved him back, and he'd fallen into a bathtub. She wasn't afraid of him now.
While the chronological record was the most important part of a case review, Ballard started with a quick survey of the photos. She wanted to see Daisy Clayton in life and in death. The photo packet included crime scene and autopsy photos, but also a posed shot of the girl in what looked to Ballard to be a private school uniform, a white blouse with a monogram over the left breast that said SSA. She was smiling at the camera, her blonde hair mid-length, makeup covering acne on her cheeks, a distant look already in her eyes. The back of the photo had been scanned as well, and it read, Grade 7, St. Stanislaus Academy, Modesto. Ballard decided to leave the crime scene photos for later and went to the chrono, first scrolling to see the latest moves on the case. She quickly learned that outside of annual due diligence checks, the investigation had largely been dormant for 8 years, until it was assigned 6 months earlier to a cold case detective named Lucia Soto. Ballard didn't know Soto, but she knew of her. She was the youngest female detective ever assigned to RHD, beating the record Ballard had previously held by being 8 months younger when appointed. Lucky Lucy, Ballard said out loud. Ballard also knew that Soto was currently assigned to the Hollywood Sexual Harassment Task Force because the powers that be in the department, mostly white men, knew that putting as many women on the task force as possible was a prudent move. Soto, who already had a media profile and nickname because of an act of heroism that led to her RHD posting, was often used as the face of the task force for press conferences and other media interactions. This knowledge now gave Ballard pause. She put together a quick chronology. 6 months earlier, Soto either requested or was assigned to the unsolved Daisy Clayton case. Shortly thereafter, she was reassigned from the open unsolved unit to the harassment task force. Then, Bosch shows up at Hollywood Station to ask questions about the case and attempt to get a look at the files of a sex crimes detective. There was a connection there that Ballard didn't have yet. She quickly found it and started to understand things better when she conducted a new search of the department database and called up all cases that listed Bosch as a lead investigator. She zeroed in on the last case he handled before leaving the LAPD. It was a multiple victim murder involving an arson of an apartment building in which several victims, including children, died of smoke inhalation. On several of the reports associated with the case, Bosch's partner was listed as Lucia Soto. Ballard now had the connection. Soto took the Clayton case on and then somehow drew her former partner Bosch into it, even though he was no longer with the department. But Ballard didn't have the reason, meaning there was no explanation as to why Soto would go outside the department for help with the investigation, especially when she was moved out of open unsolved for the task force. Unable to answer that question for the moment, Ballard went back to the case files and started reviewing the investigation from the start. Daisy Clayton was deemed a chronic runaway who repeatedly left her own home as well as the temporary group homes and shelters she was placed in by the Department of Children and Family Services. Each time she ran, she ended up on the streets of Hollywood, joining other runaways in homeless camps and squats and abandoned structures. She abused alcohol and drugs and sold herself on the streets. The first record of a police interaction with Daisy was 16 months before her death. It was followed by several more arrests for drugs, loitering, and solicitation for prostitution. Because of her age, the early arrests only resulted in her being returned to her single mother, Elizabeth, or to DCF authorities. But nothing seemed to stop the cycle of her returning to the streets and of being under the influence of Adam Sands, a 19-year-old former runaway with his own history of drugs and crime. Sands was interviewed at length by the original investigators on the case and was eliminated as a potential suspect when his alibi was confirmed. He was being held in the Hollywood Division jail at the time of Daisy Clayton's murder. Cleared as a suspect,
Sands was questioned extensively about the victim's routines and relationships. He claimed to have no information on who she had met with on the night of her murder. He revealed that her routine was to loiter near a shopping plaza on Hollywood Boulevard near Western Avenue that included a mini market and a liquor store. She would solicit men as they were leaving the stores and then have sex with them in their cars after they drove into one of the many nearby alleys for privacy. Sands said he often stood lookout for her during the transactions, but on the night in question, he had been grabbed by police on a warrant for not appearing in court on a misdemeanor drug charge. Daisy was left on her own at the shopping plaza, and her body was found the next night in one of the alleys she used for her tricks. It was naked, and there were indications of violent sexual assault and torture. Afterward, it had been cleaned with bleach. None of the victim's clothes were ever found. Detectives determined that as many as 20 hours had passed between the time she was last seen at the shopping plaza soliciting John's and when police received an anonymous call about a body being seen in a dumpster in an alley off Cahuenga. An officer, Dvorak, was dispatched to roll on the call. The missing hours were never accounted for, but it was clear from the bleaching of the body that Daisy had been taken somewhere and then used and murdered, and her body was carefully cleaned of any evidence that might lead to her killer. The one clue that the original detectives puzzled over throughout the investigation was a bruise on the body that they were convinced was a mark left by the killer. It was a circle, 2 inches in diameter on the upper right hip. Within the circle was a crossword with the letters ASP arranged horizontally and vertically with the S in common. The letters of the crossword were backwards on the victim's body, indicating that they read correctly on the device or tool used to make the mark. The circle around the crossword appeared to be a snake eating itself, but the blurring of the bruising in the tissue made this impossible to confirm. Many hours of investigative work were expended on the crossword's meaning, but no definitive conclusion was reached. The case was originally investigated by 2 homicide detectives assigned to the Hollywood Division and then reassigned to Olympic Division when the regional homicide teams were consolidated and Hollywood lost its fabled murder unit. The investigators' names were King and Carswell, and Ballard knew neither of them. Time of death was established during the autopsy at 10 hours after the victim was last seen and 10 hours before the body was found. The coroner's report listed the cause of death as manual strangulation. It further refined this conclusion by stating that marks left on the victim's neck by the killer's hands indicated that she was strangled from behind, possibly while being sexually assaulted. Tissue damage in both the vagina and anus was listed as both pre- and post-mortem. The victim's fingernails were removed post-mortem, a move viewed as an attempt by the killer to make sure no biological evidence was left behind. The body also showed post-mortem abrasions and scratches that investigators believed occurred during an effort to clean the victim with a stiff brush and bleach, which was found in all orifices, including the mouth, throat, and ear canals. The medical examiner concluded that the corpse had been submerged in bleach during this cleaning process. This finding, coupled with the time of death, led investigators to conclude that Daisy had been taken off the street into a hotel room or other location by the killer, where a bleach bath could be prepared for cleaning the body. "He's a planner," Ballard said out loud. The conclusions about the bleach led the original investigators to spend much of their time during the initial days of the investigation on a thorough canvas of every motel and hotel in the Hollywood area that offered direct access to rooms off the parking lot. The school photo of Daisy was shown to employees on all shifts. Housekeepers were quizzed about any reports of a strong odor of bleach, and trash bins were searched for bleach containers. Nothing came of the effort. The location of the murder was never determined, and without a crime scene, the case was handicapped from the start. 6 months into the investigation, the case went cold, with no leads and no suspects. Ballard finally came back to the crime scene photos, and this time carefully studied them despite their grim nature. The victim's age, the marks on her body and neck, showing the overwhelming strength of her killer, her final naked repose on a spread of trash in a commercial trash bin. It all drew a sense of horror in Ballard, a sad empathy for this girl and what she had been through. Ballard had never been the kind of detective who could leave the work in a drawer at the end of shift. She carried it with her, and it was her empathy that fueled her. Before being assigned to the night beat, Ballard had been working toward a specialization in sexually motivated homicide at RHD. Her then-partner, Ken Chastain, was one of the premier investigators of sex killings in the department. Both had taken classes from and been mentored by Detective David Lampkin, long considered the department expert, until he pulled the pin and left the city for the Pacific Northwest. That pursuit was largely sidelined by her transfer to The Late Show, but now, as she reviewed the Clayton files, she saw a sexual predator hiding behind the words and reports, a predator unidentified for 9 years now, and she felt a deep tug inside. It was the same pull that had first led her to thoughts of being a cop and a hunter of men who hurt women and left them like trash in the alley. She wanted in on whatever it was that Harry Bosch was doing. Ballard was pulled out of these thoughts when she heard voices. She looked up from the screen and over the workstation wall. She saw two detectives taking off their suit jackets and draping them over their chairs, readying for a new day of work. One of them was Cesar Rivera. Chapter 4. Ballard packed up her things and left her borrowed workstation. She first went into the print room to gather the reports she had fed into the communal printer after typing them up earlier. The detective squad lieutenant was old school and still liked hard copy reports from her in the morning, even though she also filed them digitally. She separated the reports on the death investigation and the earlier burglary call, stapled them, and then walked them to the inbox on the desk of the lieutenant's adjutant so they were ready for his arrival. She then sauntered over to the sex crime section and came up behind Rivera as he was sitting at his station and preparing for the day by dumping an airline-sized bottle of whiskey into a mug of coffee. She didn't let on that she had seen this when she spoke. "Hail Caesar." Rivera was another mustache guy, his almost white against his brown skin. He matched this with flowing white hair that was a little long by LAPD standards, but acceptable on an old detective. He jolted a bit in his seat, afraid his morning routine had been seen. He swiveled his chair around, but relaxed when he saw it was Ballard. He knew she would not make any waves.
"Renee," he said. "What's up, girl? You got something for me?"
"No, nothing," she said.
"Quiet night."
Ballard kept her distance in case she smelled like decomp.
"So what's up?" Rivera asked.
"About to leave," Ballard said. "I was wondering, though, you know a guy used to work out of here named Harry Bosch? He worked homicide." She pointed to the corner of the room where the homicide squad was once located. It was now used by an anti-gang team.
"Before I got here," Rivera said. "I mean, I know who he is. Everybody does, I think. But no, I never dealt with the guy."
"Why?" "He was in the station this morning," Ballard said.
"You mean on Graveyard?"
"Yeah. He said he came in to talk to Dvorak about an old homicide, but I found him looking through your stack." She pointed toward the long row of file cabinets running along the wall. Rivera shook his head in confusion.
"My stack?" Rivera said. "What the fuck?"
"How long have you been at Hollywood Division, Caesar?" Ballard asked.
7 years. What's that got to—
"You know the name Daisy Clayton? She was murdered in 09. It's an open case, classified as sexually motivated." Rivera shook his head.
That was before my time here, he said. I was at Hollenbeck then.
He got up and walked over to the row of file cabinets and pulled a set of keys out of his pocket to open the top drawer of his four-drawer stack.
Locked now, he said. Was locked when I left last night.
I locked it after he left, Ballard said. She said nothing about finding the bent paperclip in the drawer.
Isn't Bosch retired? Rivera said. How do you get in here? He'd keep his 999 when he split?
Every officer was given what was called a 999 key, which unlocked the back door of every station in the city. They were distributed as a backup to the electronic ID keys, which were more prone to malfunction and failure during power outages. The city was not scrupulous about collecting them when officers retired. Maybe, but he told me Lieutenant Monroe let him in so he could wait for Dvorak to come in off patrol, Ballard said. He wandered, and that's when I saw him looking in your files. I was working over in the corner, and he didn't see me.
He's the one who mentioned the Daisy case?
Daisy Clayton. No, actually Dvorak said that's what Bosch wanted to talk to him about. Dvorak was first officer on scene with her.
Was it Bosch's case back then?
No, it was worked by King and Carswell initially. Now it's assigned to Open Unsolved downtown. Rivera walked back to his desk, but stayed standing while he grabbed his coffee cup and took a long drink out of it. Then he abruptly pulled the cup away from his mouth.
Shit, I know what he was doing, he said.
What? Ballard asked. There was a sense of urgency in her voice.
I got here just as they were reorganizing and moving homicide over to West Bureau, Rivera said. The sex table was expanding, and they brought me in. Me and Sandoval were add-ons, not replacements. We both came from Hollenbeck, see?
Okay, Ballard said.
So the lieutenant assigned me that cabinet and gave me the key. But when I opened the top drawer to put stuff in there, it was full. All four drawers were full. Same with Sandoval. His four were filled up as well.
Filled with what? You mean with files?
No. Every drawer was filled with shake cards. Stacks and stacks of them crammed in there. The homicide guys and the other detectives had decided to keep the old cards after the department went digital. They stuck them in the file drawers for safekeeping.
Rivera was talking about what were officially called field interview cards. They were 3x5 cards that were filled out by officers while they were on patrol when they encountered people on the streets. The front of each card was a form with specific identifiers regarding the person interviewed, such as name, date of birth, address, gang affiliation, tattoos, and known associates. The back of each card was blank, and that was where the officer could write any ancillary information about the subject.